Good afternoon. This is the time set for oral argument in Peterson v. Peterson. Is counsel ready to proceed?
Yes, ma'am.
Very well. Please tell the clerk how much time you want for rebuttal.
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes. Madam Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the court. Marshall Willick for Louisa Peterson, seeking an order equally dividing the community property at issue by partitioning the two assets omitted from the decree of divorce and providing an opportunity to correct the error of fact in Wolf that led to the error of law in Henson that led directly to this appeal. There are three retirement assets at issue here: a defined benefit pension plan that will pay a certain sum every month, survivor's benefits, which are in the military are called SBP, Survivor Benefit Plan, and a thrift savings plan called TSP, which is like a 401k. It's a defined contribution plan with a cash balance that is simply a lump sum, which is claimable. They are separate things. Courts throughout the country have held that a spouse can be the beneficiary of the SBP and not get a portion of the pension, or vice versa. The military considers it a separate asset. The clock, the timing clock for application for the SBP doesn't even begin to run until the SBP is specifically allocated in an order, whether it's the decree or a post-judgment order dealing with the SBP. And this court has already indicated and determined that the SBP is a separate asset. In Mason, when Mr. Mason died during the appeal, the pension died with him. But this court remanded the SBP issue to the trial court for an evidentiary hearing to determine who should get it because the SBP survived. It was a separate asset. Whether it is easy or hard to do, Nevada law requires an equal division of community property absent findings of a compelling reason for a different result.
Mr. Willick, it's my understanding that Mr. Peterson had not made an election with regard to SBP during the marriage. So, like, was there an actual existing asset to divide?
You bet. In Mason versus Cuisenaire, after that case left this court, the military, and it worked its way all the way up through the DOD, made a determination that the SBP can and should be determined while the individual is still in service. Because after 9/11, there is a pre-retirement survivor annuity in military cases paying a reduced SBP if somebody dies while still in service. It's one of the distinctions between the military cases and the SBP, although they're very similar, and the PERS cases, although they're very similar in most respects. One of the differences is that there is a pre-retirement survivor annuity available in military cases.
Mr. Willick, on that same subject, the subject of the SBP, there was an observation made by the judge in the transcript, and in looking at the actual plan provisions, it raised an issue for me. Is the division of the SBP moot because it requires that occur within 1 year after the decree, and that expired September of 2019?
No, it's not moot at all. Under the military regulations, the SBP
has referred specifically to the statute that addresses the thing that we're talking
about.
Yeah,
It should be 1447, 48, 49, and 50. And under those regulations, the SBP has to be elected by the member within 1 year of the decree, but the former spouse has 1 year from the date of the order allocating the SBP to send in the application. The time clock has not started to run yet.
I didn't see the second exception you just referenced.
It's in the materials. I could dig it up. I could supply it post, but it's in all of our CLE materials. The time clock for SBP election by a former spouse does not begin to run until 1 year after the first order naming the former spouse as the SBP beneficiary. So that clock has not yet started to run.
What about Judge Pomerantz's concern that this wasn't like a 30-year marriage and he's already remarried? It appears that she used her discretion, considering the fact that he's remarried and has a new spouse. You know, you have the actual pension and during the time period that they were married already divided.
How is
your client prejudiced then?
It's dealt with in our briefs, but basically she's prejudiced because it's an unequal division of the marital property. For some pensions, it's very easy to equally divide pension interests. If this was an ERISA-based
pension. You could simply divide it into two. And she would get her part whether he lived or died, and he would get his part whether she lived or died, and it wouldn't make any difference to their divisions. But for military and PERS cases, it's much harder because you can't divide the pension into two parts. All you can divide is the stream of payments. If she dies, he'll continue getting his half. As a matter of fact, unless the court issues an order, as the court did in Wolf, requiring that the husband pay the wife's estate if she should die first, he'll not only get his part, he'll get her part if she dies. But if he dies, the pension dies with him, and she gets nothing. If it's before retirement, she gets nothing at all unless there's a private policy of life insurance under PERS, or she's the named SPP beneficiary under the military cases. And if he dies after retirement, the spouse gets absolutely nothing unless there's a survivorship. The benefits enjoyed by default in the absence of a court taking action are extremely unequal between the participant and the spouse. Because spouses have a present, existing, and equal interest in all benefits and burdens of all property that accrues during the marriage under NRS 123.225, it's the obligation of the divorce court to make those benefits equal. Applied here, it means that for the marital portion of the pension benefits to be equally divided, to try to answer your question, if he gets a survivorship interest in her life, she has to get a survivorship interest in his life too. Survivorship interests are 25 to 50% of the value of the pension.
Mr. Willick, let me ask, would you characterize it as a right or an asset? And did they need to pay premiums during the marriage? Because it's clear he didn't elect during the marriage to get this benefit, right, the SPP. So during the marriage, he didn't pay any premium or anything to make that election.
There's no premium until the time of actual retirement in the military system for a survivor benefit.
But he never elected it during the marriage.
It can be elected, but it wasn't.
Okay.
If it's not addressed on divorce, the division of pension benefits is inherently unequal in the absence of action by a divorce court. This court should follow the lead of the California courts and declare that each party has received a full community property share of all retirement assets, whether public or private, including all survivor and death benefits. That's been case law in California since the early 1980s. If a survivorship benefit is omitted from distribution, this court should declare, like the Washington courts have declared, that the parties continue to co-own it as tenants in common. The TSP, which isn't part of the pension, it's a separate asset, was also omitted. And James Brief has already confessed error as to omission of an order dividing all the marital assets that were ever put into the TSP during marriage. What's needed on this appeal is a directive from this court to the trial courts that when an omitted asset is identified, the order for its disposition should be based on actual evidence. As this court can tell just from the answering brief in this case, the court's holdings in Wolf and Henson are being misused to cause unjust enrichment. The underlying error in Wolf was factual, not legal. The case is completely sound as a matter of community property theory, but declaring the division a permanent and equal one doesn't make it so. In fact, the former spouse is totally unsecured until actual retirement. There is no pre-retirement survivor annuity under PERS. That's the error of fact in the Wolf holding. The spouse's division of benefits are not paid to her estate in the event the spouse dies. They automatically refer to the participant. This kind of pension doesn't allow a separate interest to be created, no matter what a court orders. These errors, in fact, caused the court in Wolf to reverse the requirement for a life insurance policy securing the wife's pension interest, claiming that it violated the equal division mandate of NRS 125.150. But in actuality, the decision caused the violation of the equal division mandate because he was automatically secured. Her death would not influence his benefits at all. And he had a full reversionary interest in the benefits that would have accorded to her. The decision did not mandate an option for a survivorship benefit. Without it, the wife was left totally unsecured after retirement, just like she was totally secured before retirement. If he dies, her benefits stop. That's why it's an unequal distribution, because it doesn't work the same way for him that it works for her. The decision created a disparity in the assets being distributed to the spouses, and the factual error should be corrected. The legal error in Henson flowed directly from the factual error in Wolf. This court recited incorrectly that under PERS, quote, neither the employee nor the non-employee spouse automatically receives a survivor beneficiary interest. That's just not true. But on that basis, on the basis of that false fact, this court held that a supposedly equal division of a pension did not include a survivor beneficiary interest. In reality, in every PERS and military case, the participant does have an automatic survivorship beneficiary interest in the pension. It's simply a matter of fact, but the spouse doesn't. In the military world, it's set out in 10 U.S.C. 1408C2. To have an equal division, as required by Nevada law, the former spouse must also have a survivorship. As this court held in Walsh, vague divorce language saying divide the retirement should be construed to comply with the law. But that's what was intended in the absence of express findings that something else was intended. And under NRS 125-150, the law requires an equal division of benefits and burdens. This court should include a holding that absent a career waiver by the former spouse, the district court must consider survivorship benefits an asset to be distributed at the time of divorce. In conclusion, as a matter of public policy, all assets of a community must be divided in accordance with 125-150, absent written findings of a compelling reason to do something else. The present, existing, and equal interest of the spouses requires the division of the actual benefits and burdens, the total value of the assets at issue. This court should find that survivor benefits are a valuable asset that must be addressed in each pension division. And if the pension is the kind of pension where you can't separate it out into two pieces, but only divide the payment stream, that is, PERS and military, with a reversionary interest, the SBP must be included in the distribution of benefits in order to make an equal distribution of benefits and an equal distribution of costs. It's the only way to do it. The district court should be required to take evidence for any assets that are brought to its attention afterward. And on remand, Louisa should be named the SBP beneficiary, and the marital contribution to the TSP should be divided. The reason it should be Louisa and not the later spouse is that Louisa has a 30% interest, a time rule interest, in the pension. The new spouse has a one-year overlap.
How do you know the new spouse won't be much later?
I mean, because there's not enough years left in the military career. We've calculated it, and it's in the briefs. Okay. Nobody can have a larger time rule interest than Louisa has in this particular retirement benefit. It's
not you're right. Asking for the whole state. You're asking us to make a rule for everyone.
Yes. That whenever, because it's an end.
So in our case, for example, so let's say hypothetically, for example, somebody's married 7 years, they're in PERS here, they have 30 to go. Okay? And now they have one spouse, they have another spouse later. You're saying that at the time that the first divorce occurs, that you actually have to value that survivor benefit.
No. And I'm sorry if I get that impression. I'm not. The interest must be secured because his interest is secure. The way to do it is as variable as there are cases. There could be a case, for instance, where there's already $1 million private life insurance and the survivorship benefit is an unnecessary expense. I'm not telling you how to do it. The directive from this court shouldn't be factual. It should be legal. The district court should be required to apportion the entirety of the value of the asset before them. That means the monthly failure in life and the survivorship benefits after death. And the two benefits, whether he dies or she dies, should be equal. That's the way to make an equal distribution of property. If you do anything else, then you have an unequal distribution of the marital asset. And some assets are easy and some assets are hard. To make the rule holding that you want a permanent division, this court should mandate that every member should pay the spouse's share to her estate in every case that involves a reversionary interest. That's the only way you're going to get a permanent division, which is what the Wolf Court said that this court intended to do. In the absence of that, those benefits automatically revert to the member, and you've got an unequal distribution of benefits and burdens in every case. Doing what is suggested will cure the error in Wolf and Henson and eliminate a whole bunch of unjust enrichment. I would like to reserve the last minute I've got for rebuttal, if I may.
Madam Chief Justice, Public Justice, this is a case where my client is still in the military. He's not paying for survivor benefits. He's not planning on retiring in the near future. I believe Judge Pomerantz thought that there was no asset here, and that was her finding. And she thought it was part and partial of the pension. So she didn't make any ruling under 125-150. However, the construction that the appellant wants to put in that statute, I mean, that's going to open the doors for a lot of litigation post-divorce on assets. I mean, there are literally hundreds of pension plans, union, government, ERISA, military, and you know, those pension plans are usually somewhat to protect the employee as well as look out for the spouse. But as Marcia said, when they have the reversionary clause that when the wife dies, it doesn't go to her estate. It goes back to the military member or the employee, but not to the alternate payee's estate. Is that a division that is fair? It's certainly not 50-50, but how do you come to the 50-50 or near equal division of assets? The court's going to have to look at a lot of things, and since half the litigants are pro se, I don't know if they're going to be able to cope with that burden. Of course, with regard to the TSP, we would stipulate that, you know, that's like a 401k. Louisa can get her share if there's something there. My understanding is there's nothing there, but certainly if we want to remand, they didn't do any discovery on the issue, and I got to go by what he gave me on his pay stubs throughout his career.
You only have 3 months, so do I understand that you're conceding that as to the TSP, it would be appropriate to remand and get an evidentiary answer?
I would.
Thank you. That clears up that piece of this case.
But with regard to the cases seem to be clearly that a survivor benefit is an asset when it's actually materialized. I know that the appellant sent over an order, and the order was, the first order was he wanted something divided that really wasn't in existence at the time. I think that the court should look at this, look at Judge Pomerantz. She exercised her discretion after hearing the evidence, maybe not all the evidence, but at least as far as the survivor benefit plan. She decided that it was not the appropriate time to divide it.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Sorry. So I think I'm looking at the opposition to the motion to alter or amend that I think you filed on behalf of Mr. Peterson in the district court, and you acknowledged in that brief that it's true that the TSP and SPP were inadvertently omitted from the decree. Is that correct?
Well, apparently so, even though I wasn't the attorney at the time,
okay,
but they both had attorneys, and they obviously put in the division of the pension, but there's no mention.
Right.
And there was no evidence that they even talked about it.
Right. So no one's saying, you know, we made the informed decision that we would rely on this instead of possibly paying for the annuity or things like that. No one's saying that.
It's not that type of case.
Okay. So that being the case, why does this the statute governing omitted assets not apply? It seems like Judge Pomerantz was under the impression that she couldn't address this, that the divorce decree was done and time had passed. So does NRS 125.150 sub 3 not allow the court to now address it if it was omitted by mistake?
That, I think, was the whole purpose of the statute, to correct that. It's similar to the California statute that does that. But And Judge Pomerantz seemed to think that it was not an omitted asset.
Well, Judge Pomerantz also says that they had two attorneys, both of them.
Right.
They had two attorneys. They're bargaining their various properties. So perhaps it's not an omitted asset. Perhaps something occurred where there was something. I mean, it kind of looks like she's almost saying she's not. Because there was that, they both had sophisticated attorneys, maybe it's not an omitted asset.
Well, I think that could be inferred, but there's nothing in the record that indicates that. And, the two attorneys that were involved, legally were the appellant and a former legal aid attorney who was in private practice, who was a very competent attorney, but maybe there should be a checklist or something to cover all deferred assets. I think there is. But I would, in their brief, I noticed they talked about, they cite a case and talk about the person with the largest insurable interest should get the survivor benefit in case of a remarriage. Insurable interest, I don't know if that's up. Usually insurance companies decide what that is. But in a case where you do have someone who is in the military ongoing, he's married to a spouse, she's accumulated a certain interest in the pension and survivor benefit, why should the subsequent spouse not get part of that if she's married equally as long to the gentleman? And then we have the quagmire of there's so many rules, and there's federal preemption, and the Defense Finance Office, they have their own rules. Are the judges and the litigants expected to know every rule there is on pensions? In fact, I'm sure that the appellants, they handle pensions and 401ks and different deferred benefits, stock options for all kinds of plans. And, I just think this is going to open the floodgates of litigation.
Mr. Smith, I just had a question. I realize you weren't in the Kate divorce, so you're looking back through the prism of what happened. You weren't there as the attorney at the time the divorce was entered. But looking at it now, do you believe that there is a community property interest for Louisa Peterson in the SVP based upon the time they were married?
Absolutely. But, whatever her timeshare is, she's entitled to it.
Well, isn't that ultimately what Mr. Willick's asking for, whatever the community interest is? Like you said, I don't know the dates and the times of his military service, but if he's remarried, I assume you take the total amount prorated by the time they were married, and then 50% of that would be community, I assume.
No, that's true. And Judge Pomerantz, by saying that right to survivor's benefits should have been elected, it was part and parcel of the pension and should have been part of that order in the decree.
In her order, she says on lines 23 through 26, there was a discussion of military members' benefits, it being up to council to make an award of those benefits and make the necessary inquiries, and the survivor benefit portion of the pension that should have been addressed at the time the parties were divorced. I took that sentence by Judge Pomerantz to mean that the parties, if they read the plan, would have recognized that there is a SVP provision, and they should have known it. And therefore, because they appeared to look at it and didn't, it's not an omitted asset.
It's an implied waiver. And the appellant saying, no, it just wasn't ruled on. It was ruled on.
Returning to Justice Kadish's point about what the statute provides in defining an omitted asset, was the omission of the SDP a mistake? Was it volitional? we don't, the judge in her order seems to say the lawyers should have been on notice that that's a provision, that's a term in the pension, and they chose not to address it. So why should I address it as an omitted asset?
Well, that's exactly correct, Justice. I think that...
That's how I took your argument in responding to Mr. Willick in your briefs.
Yes.
That it, so, I mean, the threshold question is whether or not something that is explicitly spelled out in the regulations describing the plan and one of the lawyers, each party being represented, doesn't address it, how does it become an omitted asset under the statute?
Under those circumstances, it's not an omitted asset. It was the attorneys negotiated a deal where that benefit wasn't included, or the without reading the record of or having access to what the attorneys discussed, it appears to be they waived.
Was there an evidentiary hearing in front of Judge Pomerantz to inquire into why this was an omitted asset? That's my concern.
No, there wasn't. This was a negotiated divorce, stipulated divorce.
No, I'm talking about the hearing where...
Post-divorce.
Yeah. Was there an evidentiary hearing where the parties were brought in, the lawyers were brought in and said, how come you guys didn't talk about SBP under... whatever section that section is that Mr. Willick quoted. How come you guys didn't do that? And if the parties said, or the lawyers said, well, we read it and we forgot it, well, does that form a basis for being an omitted asset? I'm not sure that it does.
Yeah, there was no evidentiary hearing, and the appellant, their associate at the time, I don't recall him asking for an evidentiary hearing on that. They just sent over an order and disputed the judge and us not signing it. So,
well, whose burden is it to demonstrate within the three-year period that an asset was omitted due to whatever the statute is, mistake or fraud?
Well, it would seem to be the appellants. I mean, they have to get something filed within the three-year period, and this was at the end of the three-year period. And
but it was timely. I mean, it was a timely filing.
Yeah, it was a timely filing, but they just wrote a motion asking as a matter of law that this be deemed an omitted asset, and Judge Pomerantz...
as best as you know, there was no evidence submitted.
No.
By either side.
By either side.
And Mr. Smith, in your opposition to their motion to alter or amend, you said, quote, it is indeed true that the TSP and SBP were inadvertently omitted from the decree and that the present motion was made within the three-year time limit. Is that right?
Yeah. It was, but whether it was inadvertent or not, that's a question of fact. I have no basis for saying that two experienced attorneys just simply forgot to put discuss it, or I suppose ideally that language could have been put in that parties have discussed this, and Louise, the appellant, waives any interest in the benefit. But in fairness to Louise, the appellant, I mean, this is where this type of survivor benefit is good. She had three kids. I mean, obviously, if he died, she has insurance for child support and other things for the kids. But I don't know how you equalize the situation. Say he had a couple $100,000 in a trust savings plan, like a 401k, and she'd get $100,000, she would have that, and that could pass on to her estate. But in this case, with the survivor benefit, if the wife dies, he gets that back, and her estate is nothing. So I'm saying that this type of benefit, I mean, it's like insurance. That's the purpose of it. But then, I think it was the Wolf case you cited, there is the possibility of just getting life insurance, to cover.
Well, are you agreeing that this should be remanded for the district court to determine whether, and if so, how to award the survivor benefit? Or are you saying we should not do that?
Well, I think it needs to be remanded on the trust savings plan.
Understood. But
on this, I think that I would have to agree with Justice Hardesty that they, two competent attorneys discussing this, they implicitly waived that benefit.
Okay. Thank you. Your time is up, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Willick, even if the court were to determine it was an omitted asset for purposes of argument, the court doesn't have to name the plaintiff as survivor beneficiary, correct? I mean, that's an asset that can be valued, as counsel alluded to at the end, you can buy life insurance. I mean,
the point is not the form of security, it's the fact of security that's important. Because he has, they have an insurable interest in one another's lives. This is automatically covered.
What about, though, say PERS, because let's go back to, say, state PERS, if we're talking about survivor benefits. And in this case, you know, you have a wife or you have one with three kids, but it could also be where you have a shorter marriage or the same time, and then you have a longer marriage
exactly.
with three more kids.
Exactly.
And you're saying that before somebody retires, you're going to value that survivor benefit.
You don't necessarily have to value it. It's a matter of securing it in some way. If you're going to make it private insurance, you may have to do evaluation. But there's many ways of skinning this cat, and I'm not saying that has to be done. I'd like to answer Justice Hardesty's question directly, because the statute was directly written for this purpose, for this exact fact situation. The statute puts the burden on the party who I'd like to be able to...
Please answer that.
The statute explicitly places the burden going forward on the party who is asserting that there has been an actual division or a waiver of the asset. If it's omitted, if it existed at the time of divorce and it's not distributed by the divorce decree, the burden is on the party asserting that somehow it was waived or given up or traded or whatever to prove that. It is the burden on that party, the party who's unjustifiably enriched. That was the way the statute was structured. It's in the legislative history. I know because I wrote it. And it was consciously decided that that's how it should operate. I'd like, if I could, to address the word sophisticated.
Okay, yeah.
Just one more thing.
Yeah, you have another 20 seconds.
Parties are not sophisticated. Frankly, there are very few, there's no programs. There are very few lawyers and extraordinarily few judges who really understand every aspect of this and are capable, without guidance, of being able to adequately distribute it. The point to this court is to issue as a matter of law the guidance that the benefits and burdens of each asset under 125-150 have to be divided equally. Leave it to the trial courts as to how to do it, because there's 100 different ways of skinning the cat. But this court should give the guidance that it be done. Thank you.
Do you have a question, Justice Sivert?
Thank you very much. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The matter will be under submission and will be in recess until the further call of the court.